Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of The Film Stage Show, the podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me, as always, my co-stars. There's Danny King, writer for The Film Stage.
Thank you.
Everybody's favorite person, Amanda Waltz.
Hi, guys.
Wow, way to live up to expectations. And then we also have, back in the studio, for today at least, Nick Newman.
Hi.
Hey.
The master returns.
Yeah. I like how I said in the studio, like we don't just do this remotely over Skype.
Like I didn't look at the clock and see it was 2:01 p.m. and think, oh, I have to open Skype.
We are so professional. Anyway, Nick Newman, you are back today specifically to talk about Clouds of... I'm going to do this again, aren't I? It's just Clouds of Sils Maria, right?
Yeah.
It's not The Clouds of Sils Maria?
It is not.
Oh, boy. All right. Well... That's
you always
want
to add a "the" to all the titles.
Because it seems like there should be a definite article.
No, it doesn't really make a difference.
All right,
I mean, it does, but...
It does. But anyway, so Clouds of Sils Maria, and this movie is the newest film by Olivier Assayas?
Assayas. Yeah.
Well, this is just not going to be my podcast, is it? It stars Juliette Binoche. Did I do that one right, at least?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, I think.
Yes, you did it correctly.
Kristen Stewart. No, I got that one. And Chloe Grace Moretz. We are probably not going to have an intro discussion. There were many ideas bandied around. We were first going to talk for 2 hours each about the new Batman v Superman trailer and then the Star Wars The Force Awakens trailers. But then we decided not to. Then we were going to do a discussion of most pretentious movie titles, but then we realized that Nick Newman probably had that one all locked up with On the Memory of the Turning of the Gate.
On the Occasion of Remembering the Turning Gate?
That's the one.
I don't see why that's really pretentious.
Come on. Come on.
It's not like a British period drama. It's like it's a sex-filled South Korean movie, you know?
That's fine. I'm not talking about the movie itself. I'm talking about the title. Anyway, it doesn't matter. So we're just going to skip over that. We do have some fan reaction that we can go through, though. Apparently, our like Hail Mary of just talking about Kimiko the Treasure Hunter, which is not a wide release movie, not a movie I've heard a lot about, apparently that was a pretty big episode for us.
Well, you did demand that people write in.
Because I was so upset.
Yes, we know.
And in fact, that brings us to the first response on the Film Stage Show web site, so at thefilmstage.com, and then in the features section, someone posted on the page for the show under the handle JF. I'm just going to call you Jay. I'm sorry to say this episode was disappointing. I was anticipating at least a few well-composed insights, and then he goes on to be upset that I was so upset. He says that my shock and frustration with the basic element of the story derailed the podcast. Sorry if anyone felt that way. I do know that B. Priestley 32, responding to JF, said, there's nothing wrong with having an emphatic reaction, and especially if the reaction is the product of a potentially legitimate criticism. And then he also said that my reaction was funny, which is how I read it. JF then does not agree. I'm not going to read the whole thing. Anyway, I'm glad people are listening. I'm glad people have opinions. Sorry if anyone was turned off by my flabbergasted reaction. Hopefully you will be able to see the movie and make up your own mind. In that same vein, we had an email come through.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Really good email.
Really good email. This one is from Blake. Not going to read the whole thing. Blake.
Very long.
It's very long, but that's what we like. We like people engaging in the discussion. He is a first-time listener. So thanks. Again, I did not realize that Kimiko would get us things like this, but I'm happy to hear it. I'm glad people are out there watching interesting movies. Blake said, as a first-time listener who happened upon your podcast, looking to hear something different on Kimiko the Treasure Hunter, which I had seen recently, one of the hosts invited listeners' interpretations, that was me, and I had a slightly different interpretation. So he then goes on to say, he read it more as an existential drama than a comedy, so I think he's coming down a little bit on my side. There are comedic elements, but they were always played dark, and it had to do with her alienating nature. Most of the scenes in Japan are established with her perspective and how insulated she felt and how hard it was for people to react to her. And then he goes on to say that even in Minnesota, she continues to call her mother, trying to reach back to her old life as the difficulties mount in her new one until she breaks off completely. So he is basically saying here in this email that she had a delusion predicated on a misunderstanding that grew as she became more distant from her, the torrid torpor of her life. I like that alliteration. So
yeah, that was good.
Kind of a splitting. Everyone that read this, did you have an opinion? Do you think that Blake here was onto something?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was well reasoned.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, Danny. Go ahead.
I think, like Brian said, it seems to side a little bit more with him than my my reading, which got
you
some...
guys do realize that film criticism isn't a competitive sport, right?
Are you fucking kidding me right now, Amanda?
I'm just kidding.
No, I do like that he said at some point, I don't think she was completely crazy because she seemed to be running from the real world consequences. And so that would mean that she had some grasp on reality.
Yeah, and I really agreed with that interpretation of it.
Yeah. So I thank you, Blake. This helped. I think this helped to bridge the gap between my stranded and startled reaction and the lucidity with which some other people were able to approach this movie. Nick, you saw Kimiko, correct?
Yeah, I also did an interview with the Zellner brothers and Rinko Kikuchi.
Oh, excellent. And they can find that on the film stage, I imagine?
Oh, yes, you can.
And what did you think of the film?
Oh, I liked the film quite a bit. I was initially unsure as to kind of the... I don't know, some of the austerity of the early sections felt a little put on, but I think that once it gets into the Minnesota section and you kind of see how intentional the delineation of that is, I kind of found myself falling into it a bit more and getting into its rhythm more and more. And by the end, I was really deeply moved. I found the last scene... I find it weird that anybody would think the last scene is sort of this unearned happy ending. I think it's overbearingly, incredibly sad.
That's what I thought.
That final... just those final 3 minutes or so. Particularly with that song that plays over the end credits, it really kind of... it shook me up a bit, more than I was expecting. And the movie has stayed with me since then. I mean, it's such a beautiful looking film. And I say that as someone who only watched it on their TV, you know, connected to a Vimeo screener. So I wish I'd seen it on a big screen. But overall, yeah, I do like the film a lot.
And Blake would agree with you. He said the scenes of her wandering nature at the end had a powerful effect and the movie lingered. And I have to agree. So Blake, thank you for writing in. Feel free to write in again. We always love getting well thought out emails like this. I have to say, I listen to a lot of other podcasts, and a lot of time their emails are like one-line things. We are the only podcast that I know of that sometimes gets just full-on essays. And I love that. I remember the reaction to our podcast about The Immigrant and the reactions we got from that. And yeah, love it. So keep it coming, guys. And then turning to Twitter briefly, I just want to give a shout-out to Luke, who tweeted, "Finally listened to my first episode of the Film Stage Show. Distressed emoji. I think I'm addicted."
Ooh.
Luke, as a student and admirer of addictions, you could have picked a lot worse ones. I'm very, very glad that you're addicted to our podcast. I'd also like to point out Jesse Karp, who, when our Film Stage Twitter handle asked, "Can a deeply tragic story be comedic?" He said, "The best are." I tend to agree. Good work, Jesse Karp. Thank you for writing in. That's it. So let me use this chance to remind everyone to rate us on iTunes, give us a star rating, give us a comment. Also, as I said, thefilmstage.com, you can find the posts that these podcasts are put under, and you can comment on those, as JF did. Sorry again, JF. I'll try to be better this week. And, of course, you can email us, as Blake did, at podcasts@thefilmstage.com. That is that. Let us move now into our feature review of the newest film by Olivier Assayas, Clouds of Sils Maria.
Yes, this is Valentine, Marie Andrew's personal assistant.
I owe everything to him. He asked me to join him in Sils Maria, where he lives for part of the year. In the play you all know, Maloya Snake, he gave me everything I needed to build a career on, my career.
Maria Endas!
Klaus is a great director, just hear him out.
Maloya Snake. For me, it was more than a role. I played Sigrid when I was 18.
And because you were Sigrid, only you can be Helena now.
So who's gonna play Sigrid?
Joanne Ellis.
I will play the one who drives her to suicide.
She's probably my favorite actress.
You mean more than me.
She's totally fascinating. Despite her superpowers.
Oh my god, I hate you sometimes so much.
So Clouds of Sils Maria is the story of Maria Enders, played by Juliette Binoche. And she is an actress who broke onto the scene playing the lead role of a play called The Maloya Snake. And she is about to give an honor to the man who wrote that play and became a filmmaker when she gets news that he has passed away. The rest of the film is an examination of her response to that, her response to being offered a role in the remake of said film slash play, and her take on the state of movie making and storytelling in general. Co-stars Kristen Stewart as her personal assistant, and Chloe Grace Moretz as the young upstart actress and tabloid bait that will be playing the role that she had popularized 20 years earlier. Nick Newman, you're new back, so why don't you give us your thoughts first? What did you think of Clouds of Sils Maria?
Well, it's been a while since I saw this movie, admittedly. I think I saw it sometime in late September.
What are you doing here?
as part of the New York Film Festival. It was one of my most anticipated of the festival in the year, period. And fortunately, I was quite happy with it. I mean, I think at this point, I'm kind of so far up Asias's ass that, you know, I'm just gonna sort of like anything he does, just to some extent. Which doesn't mean I like every film of his. Certainly,
right.
There's some that I think are actually really quite notable stumbles, and others that kind of have the ideas there, but they don't really click because he is. If nothing else, he's quite ambitious, and you know, he's a guy who made this movie called. Have you seen Demon Lover from 2002?
No,
no.
But it's this movie
that basically takes these theoretical concepts about like Guy Debord's Society of the Spectacle and, you know, sort of theories about 21st century, the way that the internet is changing our perception of the world, and relates that to a thriller about a business deal regarding hentai.
Oh my god!
Wow.
It's an insane fucking movie, and he's one of those guys who, you know, can do something like that and make it feel really intelligent. Even though Demon Lover is kind of like one of the, I think it's one of the great smart stupid movies or stupid smart movies. There's this scene in it where Gina Gershon is smoking a cigarette and she says, "If we control the hentai and any other all sorts of animated." Animated debauchery will have 75% of the world market, or something like that.
Wow.
And it's funny because in Clouds of Sils Maria, there's a scene where the characters go see this awful, terrible science fiction movie that almost is spoofing. He is a guy who works, I think, I would say he kind of works in circles in a lot of ways. He's kind of circling a lot of the same ideas, and his films themselves have kind of a concentric quality to them. They often have some sort of unsolvable problem at their center, and I think in Clouds of Sils Maria the unsolvable problem is aging, and more specifically how people perceive you when you're aging, and that you'll never be young again, and that you're just always going to be changing, you're always rapidly changing, but if you're playing a performance you can sort of stay in stasis, and the problem at the center for Maria Enders, the lead character played by Juliette Binoche, is that she is kind of moving in circles again, but this time she's in a different position. Now she's taking this elder role from a play where she once played the youthful character. And the struggle that she faces is not unlike what Maggie Cheung goes through in his 1996 film Irma Vep, which is, I think, one of the great movies in the 1990s, really, and one of the great movies about filmmaking. This is decidedly less so about filmmaking. It's actually more about theater. And I think that the sort of the Jacques Rivettian scenes of performance walking around reciting this dialogue. It's herself and her assistant, played by Kristen Stewart. What is that character's name again?
Valentine?
Valentine, yes, of course.
Yeah.
I should say, of course, because I interviewed Asayas at the New York Film Festival, so I had to write the name Valentine like several times when we ended up talking about her.
It sounds like more of a male name than a female name.
Yeah, it's an interesting name.
It's confusing.
She keeps calling her Val, which I usually think as a female name, but then I just remembered Val Kilmer exists, so now I don't even know what to think.
I think Valerie. There's a thing.
Yeah.
More Valerie than something. Anyhow.
That's
the
name.
Maybe.
One thing that I find interesting about the movie, one of its great strengths is that these scenes where they're going over the play and it's about aging, youth, perception. And there are some times where it's difficult to tell if they're actually reading from the play or they're arguing with each other. And sometimes you only see this because you realize that they're both holding a little booklet in their hands, the play itself. Mm-hmm. What's funny is that it really is not for one second ambiguous as to how this text relates to the story at hand. It's very, very obvious. But the movie knows that. And the way that it plays with sort of how easily you can read something versus the complexities that kind of underlie everything that happens in everyday life, I find very, very exciting. I think that kind of speaks to the performances themselves, which again, kind of are dealing with this surface-level material, but are filled with these various complexities of physical gestures and facial movements, and sort of shifting around in a space, trying to make yourself comfortable, but clearly being a bit uncomfortable. One great example of that is the scene where they meet with the Chloe Grace Moretz character, who's sort of this troubled teen idol or whoever. And it's one of those scenes where everybody is kind of acting casual and is trying to sort of, you know, be in the good graces of each other, but everybody's very clearly uncomfortable for one reason or another. But nobody's uncomfortable for the exact same reason. Which I find very, I find very fascinating. Even the sort of like boyfriend character, it's been a while. Even that guy kind of doesn't want to be there. Even he is thinking, okay, this conversation is going in weird directions. It's always shifting around, but kind of always talking about the same thing, much like the film itself. And then that extends, I think, to Asayas's, you know, quote-unquote direction filmmaking. I just say quote-unquote because it's such a broad term. But, I mean, you look at something like the opening scene, for example, which I think is this really amazing use of shifting perspective and how the camera and the cutting are always kind of dictating what mental process Kristen Stewart's character Valentine is versus when she's on her phone and when she's not on her phone. The way that she's kind of sucked into the world of her phone, how she's kind of connected to everything. And you have these, like, over-the-shoulder shots of her looking at her phone, and that's kind of her dominant mode of vision. And then, you know, she's on the phone, she's talking, but she's kind of looking at the train. She's trying to find something else. She's looking out. She's trying to, like, you know, not be in that world. She's trying not to be sucked into everything. And then only when she goes into the cart, the train cart, with Maria, can she finally settle in a bit. Can she feel a bit more at home, a bit more human? It's this kind of attention to detail that I think really makes the film in a lot of ways. And for me, it's just, you know, it's one of those weird, it's one of those kind of, you know, to say it's understated, I think is somewhat correct. But again, the movie is kind of moving in so many different directions at once that it's understated, yet it's very obvious what it's saying. It's, you know, pretty much anybody could see this and sort of figure out its thesis. And yet there are these weird complexities that are always coming up. Particularly, and I won't give it away, but particularly sort of the final encounter between Maria and Valentine, which basically plays like a Swiss La Ventura, to reference the Antonioni movie. That's what came to mind most. And it's actually, you know, it's a fairly literal thing, what happens, but it is this weird, mystical, magical realist kind of spin on a very simple solution to a fairly simple problem, which is that two people sometimes just don't get along after a while. And yeah, it's these things that make the movie pretty special for me. So overall, this is a long-winded way of saying I'm a big fan of Clouds of Sils Maria.
All right. Amanda Waltz, what did you think?
Yeah. Obviously, Nick has more of a history with this movie. But I just watched it a couple hours ago, and I really enjoyed it. Actually, it's interesting because before I watched it, I was describing the plot to a friend, and she immediately referenced All About Eve. So going into it, I think I had a different idea of what it might be like, and I was pleasantly surprised that it wasn't that sort of typical, you know, spoiled aging actress who's being replaced by young ingenue. You know, it had some really, really surprising elements, and I agree with Nick's interpretation of how it's very obvious that the play is of Marie and Val's relationship sort of mirrors the codependent relationship in the play, and it makes no, you know, it's not trying to I think it's not trying to portray it with any subtlety, and I think the scenes of them, you know, they take residence in this very I think it's was it in Switzerland, right?
Yes.
So they're in Switzerland, and they sort of they go to rehearse this play, and they're in this cabin that's in the mountains, and it's sort of this like, I really want to immerse myself in this character, and so they're rehearsing, and there's such an effortlessness to those scenes of them rehearsing together that it is true that when that sometimes the lines between whether or not they're rehearsing or having a conversation are blurred, because it'll come into the middle of them having a conversation. And then, like you said, like Nick said, then you see a book, like one of them has the play, a copy of the play in her hands. And, you know, it's actually, I'm not that familiar with the director's work. So doing some research, I thought this film is very personal for him, because it seems like he has a history with his actresses that is very intimate. He married Maggie Cheung, who starred in a few of his movies, and then he married the starlet who was in, is it Late August, Early September, who was 17 when they met, and then they married when she was 20. So I wonder if this movie is sort of his way of sort of grappling with his history with his act with these women that he's worked with. And in that way, I found it, you know, reading it from that perspective, I found it almost sort of like weirdly loving. I don't know. It was like, because I think the way Juliette Binoche is portrayed is she's kind of a mess, but she is a very talented woman, and she's a talented mess. Yes, but she,
and even her mess isn't that messy compared.
Yeah, well, compared to Chloe Grace Moretz's character Joanna, as we find out later, is just. And one of the things that I really enjoyed about this movie is how everyone is acting all the time, and there's even a scene where her old flame Henrik, who was in the film adaptation of Maloya Snake with her, like when he comes in to speak with her, and it's right after they found out that Wilhelm died, and he is talking about him, but it almost sounds like a monologue, like he's delivering a monologue, and there's something so incredibly just fake about it. And I don't know, it just seems like this movie is the way it portrays fame and the way it portrays just how actors are. And I don't know. I think it was such a like there are scenes where you kind of, I think, what do I want to say? I'm trying not to be like, yeah, it's an interesting film. I'll say that much. Cause I feel like I don't want to talk too much about it because I'm going to start getting into spoilers. So I'd rather have like Danny talk about it, and then we can get into spoilers so I can.
Oh, so you're not going to let me talk about it.
Oh, and Brian, you may talk about
no,
it as well.
No, we're letting Brian talk.
Danny King, why don't you talk and then we can get into spoilers?
Sorry, dude.
No, whatever.
Brian's just here to organize us. He makes. Yeah, I agree.
Shepherd
with,
don't give no wool, right?
Yeah, Shepherd. Yeah.
I feel like that was a decent analogy. Shepherd doesn't give a wool. It doesn't matter.
I've never heard that idiom before.
I just made it up right now. It's great.
Did you really?
Yeah.
No, you didn't.
I swear to God, I did.
All right.
All right. Well, at least I've added that to the lexicon, even though I won't get to talk about this movie. Danny King, why don't you tell us what you thought of Clouds of Sils Marie?
I agree with a lot of what's been said. I like the film a lot. It sort of took a while to work on me, particularly at the beginning. Nick was talking about that opening scene, and I do really like the filmmaking in that scene, but it's almost like, in terms of subjectivity, since you're aligned with Kristen Stewart's character right away, you're sort of overwhelmed with all this information. So you have these two famous actresses, one of them playing a famous actress, the other one playing her assistant, and they're talking about all these fictional people and these fictional works. And it could just be a little overwhelming at times, like which stuff should I actually be processing? What is just sort of like filler for their conversation? But once the movie sort of gets into the Alps section, I was kind of really won over. And I agree with what both Nick and Amanda said about not being turned off by the obviousness, because for me, it just took a while to figure out what the movie was doing. So once I realized the relationship between the Maria-Val relationship and the play they're rehearsing, it wasn't like a moment where it's like, oh, that's an obvious device. It was kind of like a quiet revelation of emotional stakes, because the movie is sort of this weird contrast between, on the surface, it seems like kind of a gentle hangout movie where these two women are just kind of smoking and talking and gossiping. And it's really fun just to watch them hang out. But as the movie goes on, you realize these very serious emotional stakes that exist. And not just for Binoche, but even for the Val character, who seems to want this respect from Maria. And it's interesting because it seems very clear to us, at least, that Maria does respect her, and there seems to be a very healthy relationship there, but there's something we don't quite understand about Val. But another thing I really liked about the film was sort of the presence of time in it. The movie is sort of, scenes end with these fade outs, and you kind of never really know how much time passed in between each fade out. And right for the Alps section, there's an interesting cut to like a part two title card. And it's like, oh, I didn't even realize we were watching part one. Like, because there's, and then that part two title card, one of the first scenes after that is at the gas station, and you see Juliette Binoche, and she has like trimmed hair. And she looks totally different. And it's like this amazing moment of she's totally transformed, kind of, and she looks like a new person.
Do you think Asayas just forgot to put in a part one title card? And then he was at the premiere and went, oh, fuck.
Really messed up.
I was thinking it was going to be like a play where it was three acts.
Oh, yeah.
Which I was like, oh, no, I really hope it doesn't do that.
Which I think maybe someone at the press conference said, such a brilliant touch, not putting a part one title card. He went, yeah,
that's great.
All the reviews focus on like the part two title card.
the thing there is that there really is no part one, because life is a continuum, and you may feel as though you've entered the second stage, but really it's I don't know, it doesn't fucking matter.
It's a flat circle.
Yeah, time is a flat circle. Damn right. And with an epilogue.
Another thing that was kind of funny is, so I mentioned how a lot of this film seems really relaxed in a kind of pleasing way. Like, you just kind of go with the flow of their conversations. At one moment, there's a Kristen Stewart's like getting ready to go to a party. So there's a cut to a shot of her in her car. And my reaction is like, oh, cool. Like, Asayas is going to, like, do one of his signature party set pieces. But when it cut to that shot of the windshield, the woman next to me, like, gasped in horror. And I was like, whoa, what, like, what are you seeing in this film? And sure enough, it launches into this, like, bizarre montage montage of, like, superimpositions and Kristen Stewart's characters, like, throwing up. And it's, like, totally unlike anything in the movie. So
and like, it's never addressed.
Yeah.
And there are very surreal moments in this movie.
Yeah.
And so I was, like, blown away by this woman next to me that something, like, triggered in her where she's like, oh, of course, this is, like, the montage part where she's going to throw up.
Just like I had with Fast and Furious 7 where I was like, oh, this is the part where they talk about family.
Oh.
You know, some people, me and that woman, we just have that touch.
It's a talent.
It's a real genetic mutation we got.
Like you guys said, another thing I really liked about the movie was this like surreal quality, where things happen that seem to have like a mystery to them. I think the first cut to like the silent film of the cloud and the Alps.
The Maloa snake.
Which is a real thing.
A real thing. Okay.
Yeah. I looked it up.
Thanks, Brian.
After Kimiko the Treasure Hunter, I've begun looking up things in movies to see if they're real or if the guy just needed a happy metaphor. It's a real thing.
Yeah. Hmm. And so I like that. And so, yeah, it's like when they're walking through the mountains, it's like, it's interesting because it's like, okay, they're rehearsing this play and the play's reflecting their relationship, but there is this like third layer of mystery to the landscape and the environment that's never really like solved or explained. It just kind of like hovers over. So I like that too. I really like the movie.
All right. Excellent. Let's move on into spoilers.
No.
So my opinion of the film. I'll start off by saying, and I know I'm going to catch hell for this, I've never seen a movie by Olivier Assayas. I don't know why.
I've only seen his vignette in Paris Je T'aime.
Ugh. Oh.
What was that?
I hate that film so much.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know if I'd call
for
it.
For that to be the only one you've seen,
God,
it gets better.
At least I haven't seen anything.
Yeah. What's his vignette?
It's Maggie Gyllenhaal.
I mean the vignette itself is fine. It's fine. It's just like that movie just kind of gives me like a gag reflex.
I saw this movie with a friend of mine, and she had only ever seen the vignette in Paris Je T'aime, but she didn't realize that it was by the same person until the end, and she was like, "Why does that name sound familiar?" And it's actually funny because this is the same friend I went and saw Birdman with, and I feel like there's some level in which you could compare these two movies, at least in like the most barest thematic way.
I thought the same exact thing, actually.
Okay, that's good. I'm glad you know.
The Inuyuritu film?
The Inuyuritu, yes. I'll get to that in a second. I didn't want to see this film. and I had no reason to not want to see it. I think it was a combination of an astoundingly French director's name, along with the Clouds of Sils Maria title, and just the concept of Juliette Binoche and Kristen Stewart. And I know that that's unfair to everyone involved, but I didn't. I didn't want to see this film.
You don't like Binoche?
I do like Juliette Binoche, but there was something about the concept of her, and I don't even not like Kristen Stewart. But there was something about the collection of all of those pieces together that just made me say, oh God, I really don't want to see this movie.
Hmm.
But I did. And I'm glad I did, because I love this film. And one of the reasons that I love it is that it was able to tackle similar thematic material as Birdman in a way that is like better in every way than the way it was tackled in Birdman.
Agreed.
And I didn't dislike Birdman, but this movie kind of shows what a hollow, strident exercise that film was, and how the ideas in it could have been tackled much more thoughtfully, and indeed were tackled much more thoughtfully in this film. I will also say that I know that I'm having trouble eliminating the word "the" from the title of this film. I swear to Christ, I've heard about this film since Ken, and I have called it alternately The Clouds of Silas Mara, The Clouds of Sils Marina. Just like every permutation, I'm still staring at the IMDb page just to make sure that I say the correct thing. And I don't know why that's important to me, but for some reason during the course of the film, I was just really happy they kept saying Sils Maria over and over and over again. And that indeed, Sils Maria is a real place. And there's something about that, about the various levels of alienation that this film had for me, and that was still able to break through those and really reach me and really make me respect it and enjoy it. And when I finished watching it yesterday, I said to my friend, I'm really glad I have over 24 hours until I have to talk about this film, because there's a lot to go through. Luckily, as the host who goes last, I can just say, I agree with basically everything all of you said. So I don't have to formulate my own opinions. I think that something that's interesting that we all left out, however, is the way that this movie handles the way that an actor is the instrument of the storyteller.
Mm.
And that's a lot of where the real fear in this movie for Maria Enders comes from. She is in love with, or more than in love with, Wilhelm, the man who wrote The Maloya Snake and who gave her her break both on stage and in film. And she connects with the directors that she speaks to in the film more than she connects with just about anything else. Because as an actress, she is only as good as the story she's in. And I think that it's very much reflected in the way that she is rebelling against this play that she had been in and loved, but now that she's been recast, she is beginning to find all the flaws in it that she couldn't see before, because she's a completely different instrument. It's like she's a knife that's now been turned into a spoon. And she sees the way that the knife cuts and the way that it's doing all the real work in this play, and she is relegated to the spoon that's just on the side waiting for its point to do something, anything. And she talks to two different directors during the course of the film, and one of them is my favorite character in the movie, just because he is such an astoundingly on the point like caricature of a like German stage director.
This is something you know well.
I'm just saying, like, this is something that shows up as a as an on the point existentialist German stage director. The portrayal of Klaus, who is only ever referred to as Klaus,
yes,
even though I see in the credits here that his last name is Diersterweg.
Mm.
But Klaus is great. I love Klaus. He has an interview scene where he strikes the most pretentious art house German pose I've ever seen, with his legs crossed and leaning over and his hand by his face. And he says in his German accent some of the most German things I've ever heard. But he's great. And the way that he is able to convince her to take this new part is by convincing her of his vision of her character. And when she's removed from him and left solely alone with this thing that she's only ever viewed through her own eyes or the eyes of a man who saw her as the younger character, it begins to erode. And then we have perennial film stage show favorite Brady Corbet show up.
Yeah, what's... We gotta talk about this.
You know what? You know what's weird about that? Or one thing that's weird about that? So actually, Amanda, you mentioned the woman that he married who was in late August, early September. Her name is Mia Hansen-Love.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys are aware, but she herself
is a director.
She's a great director. And her new movie, Eden, is coming out. I actually saw it the day after.
Oh, the electronic music?
Yeah, yeah.
And she did Goodbye First Love.
She did, yes.
All right, I'm just trying to get some of my credibility back after saying I've never seen an séance before.
Well, you got one down.
One a little bit.
But what's funny is that I saw Eden the next day, And Brady Corbet also shows up in that.
Which one is Brady Corbet?
For like 4 minutes in Eden. Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it, no, but I'm just wondering who...
He's the a young American director that she talks to at the end of this film.
Oh, he's the Bryan Singer type?
Yeah.
I guess, yeah.
And he was also in Force Majeure.
He's in While We're Young.
He's American, right?
Right.
Wow.
He's
okay.
He has a thing about showing up in European films for like one scene. He was in Melancholia for a single scene. He was in Force Majeure. He's in this.
Would it surprise any of you if I told you that that's like, before this ever happened, that was kind of a secret ambition of mine? I'm not much interested in being an actor, but I thought if I was going to be an actor...
You'd want to be Brady Corbet.
Not Brady Corbet specifically, but I would want to just kind of show up in like these foreign productions for some reason, and like nobody really knows why I'm there. Then I just kind of recede.
I did an interview with Brady. I'm just going to call him Brady. We've spoken. It's cool.
Those are a couple old pals.
Yeah. And he's actually, I love talking to him. He's one of the favorite interviews I've ever done. And it was about his movie Simon Killer. And I asked him, like, you had a brief part in Melancholia. You were a big part, actually, in the American remake of Funny Games. And this is before, the 17 other bit parts he's had in famous European directors' films. I was like, what's up with that? Like, can you give me an insight? And he's like, yeah, I want to work with all the best people. And I mean, like, I guess that's just how he does it. He's just like, cool. I'll take anything. Doesn't matter. I'll be the guy who shows up for 15 minutes to be the date of a tertiary character's best friend in Force Majeure if it means I get to work with you. And it works. So there's
he's got something figured out.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing just be that guy in The Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's like my favorite character actor. I can't wait till he's like 76 and finally gets another lead role. but yeah, so back to what I was saying. She speaks with these directors and they're the people who give her life. They like her interaction with every other actor is exactly what you would expect if like Toy Story was about a like power tool and like a handsaw who were squaring off with each other. And it's like, there's such animosity and so much distance. And she really reacts to anyone who will be creative and give her a purpose. And that's why her interactions with Valentin are at once so chummy, but then also become so confrontational, is because Val is like her mirror and her chalkboard. And whenever Val kind of espouses another point of view, she almost doesn't respect Val enough to listen to it because Val is not a creator. She's a consumer. And as a person who creates the thing being consumed, Maria thinks that she has an ownership over the ideas that should be gotten from it.
You think Maria doesn't respect Val enough?
I don't think she does. Okay. I think that she tries to, but that there's an inherent bias in her.
Well, it's strange because it's a very codependent relationship where, like Danny was saying, Val obviously wants respect from Maria, but Maria also very much wants respect from Val.
Oh, yeah.
Because Val is this consumer, and they go to see that terrible movie with Joanne's character.
Which is just amazing.
Oh, my God.
It made me think of both the X-Men and Divergent.
Yeah, because didn't we talk about how...
Oh, was that it? Yeah, that's right.
We did. We referenced this before because we were talking about the Divergent
trailer that is coming out,
yeah, and how it looked like. Oh, it's so great. but she's trying to argue to Maria that Joanne is actually a wonderful actress, and how she brought this depth to this completely ridiculous role, and how it's sort of that. I think her argument is sort of that it's the same story that's being told in Maloya Snake. It's just in a different environment.
Right.
It's
she says if it was like in a German factory, she would have liked it more.
She's like, oh, if it was on an assembly line on a farm, you'd love it.
See, you guys, you really have to see Irma Vep because that's like the entire film.
I really want to see that.
You mean like the other reality or?
It's just the whole, the whole sort of back and forth about what constitutes proper cinema.
Oh, yeah.
And in particular, Brian, you'll appreciate this. Jean-Pierre Léaud, who's, you know, Antoine Doinel from The 400 Blow, is one of the great icons of French cinema, plays this aging director who's kind of the vision of sort of this, you know, once great artist who's kind of losing it in like a really, really significant way. And that's very much, it's very much in a similar vein to Klaus, the German theater director, because he's very much, because I mean, it's a little prankish on Assayas's part, admittedly, because he's this younger guy who's kind of poking fun at the out of touch older set, and yet it works very well.
Love me some Klaus, I will say that. There was another thing that I wanted to bring up. Oh, in relation to Birdman, this movie, while yes, it does appear to be looking down on a lot of popular culture, it does have a defending voice. It's not completely dismissive. And I think that what Kristen Stewart's Val says related to if that had been on an assembly line, you would have loved it, and talking about how these are the same stories but with different trappings, actually has a lot of value, especially in an age where we know up until like 2025 exactly which superhero movies we're going to be getting each year. that there are things like that, and that even in movies that are disparaged, such as let's say Man of Steel, there are interesting stories being told that, were they told on a smaller scale, might get more respect. You know, things like the Winter Soldier crib from the old paranoid 70s spy movies. And I think that it's an interesting point for a very European art film to make. This movie hits, like, European art film bingo for me, in that it takes place in a small, rustic, modernist house in the Alps that you see people numerous times buying very nice-looking bottled water on a train, and that there is a string quartet.
Well, and that's also, I think that the string quartet also brings up another good scene of the high versus low art argument, because it's Joanne and Christopher, the novelist, and he's talking about how, oh, I just love chamber music. It has such a bright and lively feel. And she's talking about like, oh, I just like rock and roll.
Yeah. But it's funny because she's still able to say, like, romantic music is always so, like, dour, it seems, and I just want to listen to rock and roll.
Well, and it's so obvious that she's so desperate to impress him, but at the same time...
Yeah, what does he see in her?
She is... And I think what I find interesting about this movie, too, is how it portrays her as... She is this mess. She is this hot mess of... the Lindsay Lohan type actress, like, who had potential and then completely wasted it. But she talks about how her parents were musicians, and I think she says something to the effect of they spoon fed her theater and the fine arts and things like that. And I don't know, it's almost like she's rebelling against that, but
yeah.
It's sort of working against her. But yeah, it's sort of showing that, like, oh, she's not just this shallow young actress. She actually has an artistic background, but yeah, I don't know.
She's also a good actress.
So I think the parallels to someone like Lindsay Lohan are definitely there. I mean, like, again, it's very obvious.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Okay, well, do we have any other wider thematic things we want to talk about before we talk about, I guess, some of the ending scenes and the whole epilogue, which would constitute spoilers?
I just like that nobody in the movie is really a villain.
Yeah, no.
It's something I appreciate.
No.
It's nice. It's nice to have a villain-free movie. Even people who are kind of cast as the villain initially, like Heinrich, and then even Joanne to an extent, aren't really, they're not villainous. No one's trying to hurt anyone.
Yeah, the thing about them is even if they're pretentious and stuffy and kind of not nearly as intelligent as they'd like to make themselves seem, you know, they want to make art.
Right.
You know, they want to express themselves.
There.
Yeah.
No one's ever really talking about the commercialism either. Like, even superhero movies aren't talked about as commercial. They're talked about as art artifacts that are just low art.
Well, because they even touch on the fact that him bringing... Klaus bringing Maria into this his play is obviously trying to get publicity and right. him trying to bring attention to this production that he's putting on. So,
he has a very firm artistic reason to do it.
Yeah.
And that he says that he read the play differently from her and that in his eyes,
but
Helena is Sigrid like 20 years later and he wants to make that more explicit.
But do you think that's just him bullshitting her a little bit?
It's hard to tell with him. He's so German. It's really difficult to say. I think that there's a part of him that's real about that. Just the way that he approaches things and the way that he talks about everything, he has a real thoughtfulness behind his eyes. And I feel like he's happy that he's struck a balance, but I think that he means what he says. But that's just me. Did anyone else like distrust him in that way?
It's not that it's not a distrust. I think it's just
trust Klaus.
There's obviously a symbiotic relationship.
Right, as with any director and actress.
Yeah. But you have to sugarcoat it and you have to you have to flatter a little bit in order to get what you want, and I think that is.
But there's a difference between his flattery of her and Joanne's flattery of her later on. especially just in the way that they treat her post flattery.
Oh man, yikes. Yeah.
That'll get into spoilers. Final thoughts? Anyone going once? Going twice? All right, so let's talk spoilers, just some basic plot elements and further thematic tie-ins, and then we'll do Blu-rays, and then we'll get out of here. So, spoiler one. I don't know why I'm numbering them. So, Maria and Val are walking in the mountains, and they have a very pointed conversation about the fate of Helena, the older woman in this play, the Maloya? Maloya Snake. And there's a scene apparently at the end of the play where Helena, after being ditched by her young lover, Sigrid, wanders off into the mountains. And Maria says, she's a woman who kills herself. And Val says, pointedly, and this is the first time we've ever even given a hint that the end of the play might be more vague or ambiguous, that she just walks into the mountains. It's not clear that she kills herself. She could have abandoned everything and started a new life. And then, after having a fight about this, Maria gets to the top of the valley, is excited to see the Maloya snake, and then can't find Val. So, readings on this scene and the way that it ends with the disappearance of Val. Is Val dead?
No.
Okay.
No.
I think that's the most important thing to say. I think it's pretty certain that she's not dead. Like, it's not as if there was some sort of mountain lion that kind of tackled her to the ground.
Do they have mountain lions in the Alps?
I don't know. I don't know much about it. No. They have bears?
They have mini goats.
They do have mini goats.
Okay. The mini goat shows up.
Do they have Yeti?
Did you guys stick around for after the credits when it shows her corpse being eaten by a bunch of goats?
Oh, no? Damn it.
No!
This is just like The Gray where I didn't know there was an end scene. Shit.
Yeah. Actually, at the New York Film Festival showing, Ken Jeons came out and he said, you might want to stick around after the credits. And they just gave a really terrible wink to the audience and left. So, anyway.
Oh, man.
No, I don't think she died. I think it's, again, it's one of those weird lines the movie is walking between literal and, as I said, sort of magical, realist, mystical, surreal, that kind of thing. Because, I mean, I think that, you talk about the montage sequence. If it's even a montage, it's more just like images stacked on top of each other, crossfading in and out to that rock song. Really what it is the first time she's separated from her, she freaks out because she's so connected to her.
Really? I wasn't sure how to read that scene because they never really talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that she, that maybe her relationship with Byrne, the cameraman, had gone south.
The Terry Richardson character?
Yes.
I mean, yes. That, and I think it's sort of the too strong connection she feels. And I think that a lot of the movie, from that point forward, is kind of her frustrations accumulating, and then she could finally find a way to disappear. And so for me, it makes sense because there's something very kind of like, there's something very dreamlike about that initial, again, I'll just call it montage for the sake of simplicity. Mm. Something very dreamlike and disconnected from reality about it in a movie that otherwise is very much in the now, is very much about the current right now. And so when you kind of take it to another step, there's something kind of interesting about how, if anything, in that montage, there are too many images of Valentine happening at once. You're seeing too much of her, and it creates this disorienting effect. And then once she's finally able to find herself in a place where that kind of situation is no longer going to happen, there's no image of Valentine whatsoever.
Mm.
And I find that really interesting. It's you could question, and I do question a little bit how organic it is to the rest of the film. I do think you could argue that maybe it doesn't. Maybe it's a step too far, but I nevertheless do like it enough to let it be there. And when I interviewed Asayas, I asked him, you know, how do you work your way up to that point? And he said in his very French accent, he went, "It's tiny, tiny, tiny nuances." it's tiny, tiny, tiny nuances. So sort of something like that. His just like his voice is just such a, he just goes, yeah. It's great, I love it. But one of the, if it sounds like I'm making fun of him, one of the smartest people I've ever talked to, bar none. Mm. So it's just, you know, it's a loving little thing there. But anyhow, for me it works. That's what I think of it.
For me it worked, and it's incredible because, again, going back to Birdman, there's a lot of shit in Birdman that's very obviously referencing itself. And in this, as they're walking in the mountains, and then they have this discussion about a woman walking into the mountains and disappearing and whether or not she's dead. And then suddenly you have Val disappear into the mountains. And it was just like, it one of those things that could have been just too cute, you know? Just like a real obvious thing. But for whatever reason, it really worked for me.
Well, it had an elegance because the film could have gone the route of they have a huge falling out and then we never see Val again. But I think, and that is, like Danny pointed out, the fade to black, the transition between each scene, is that we only get to see these little moments. And so for her to just disappear is really appropriate. And actually, I'll even point out, so there's the way it, her disappearance is shot, there's actually, it's actually connected with an earlier scene where there's a long take of Maria walking with Wilhelm, I believe his widow, Rosa.
Yes.
That's his widow. And so they walk and then they disappear and then they crest over the hill and you see them again. And that's repeated when she's walking. But when she crests the hill, whereas before she crested the hill and she was with Rosa, when she crests the hill, she's alone. And I think that that's an incredibly like poignant moment where I think Val was her sort of like holding on to this idea of her being secret and being young, and you know, and finally she's sort of on her own and she has to deal with that. And I don't know, I just thought it was like, I thought that was sort of like a brilliant little touch, because before it's like her and Rosa, and Rosa is her connection to Wilhelm and Wilhelm's work. And then she goes off. But yeah, I mean, I think it's, I'm wondering part, I don't know. Did you guys think that maybe Val was, I don't know, I don't want to say like, not Val, but did you think maybe Joanne too, what reflected Kristen Stewart's own career and her own troubles in real life?
I wasn't sure about where Val came from.
I know this is sort of an out of nowhere, but I just want to bring it up before I forget it, because
Are you talking about Kristen Stewart as Kristen Stewart playing Kristen Stewart?
Well, because
like, are you talking about Val or Kristen Stewart?
I'm talking about Joanne. I'm talking about how whether or not Joanne is, because I feel like.
But my question is, when you say is Joanne like a reflection of Kristen Stewart and everything?
Her real life.
It's worth noting.
Her real Kristen Stewart life.
Her real Kristen Stewart IRL, yeah.
Okay, was Joanne like Val a couple years ago?
No. I just thought it was because she had, there was that debacle with her and the Snow White and the Huntsman director.
Right.
And Joanne is having an affair with Christopher. And I was just wondering if maybe this I don't know.
It's such a universal thing.
It is worth noting that Asias originally wanted her to play that role.
Oh, really?
He did. And then she had to sort of prove to him, had to petition him a bit to say, I can play the Valentine role. The Valentine role is better for me as an actor.
Oh. She does deliver a great performance. And I will say that I think she's stuck in that jerky, hesitant style.
I love her physicality in that role, but I just think that might just be her.
I think that's just how she's going to play every character that she will ever play.
She's just such a weirdly like self-conscious person.
Yeah. But I think it really worked in this film.
Oh, yeah.
I think she did an amazing job.
She's so in control, and then to see her like move around and, you know, she's got her arms tattooed up and her hair is like constantly in her face and she's like, just looks like a mess. She looks like she woke up 15 minutes late to every scene, but it works for some reason. And I really like it. I don't even mean that as like,
being a personal assistant has to be a nightmare though.
Yeah, exactly.
So
it would have been weird if she was perfectly put together.
Oh yeah.
And I like that, you know, she's standing next to Maria in these Coco Chanel dresses, and she looks like, you know, she woke up on a bus and just like staggered onto set. But she
looks that bad, Brian, like she's slept on a bus.
Yeah. Like, well, she doesn't look like she's ever showered.
I will say it seems like no one is wearing makeup in this film except for Joanne, because I don't know. It seems like Maria's never wearing makeup. And maybe that's just, as a woman, that's just something
Klaus
I've noticed.
Klaus is wearing some makeup. Mm. A little foundation on Klaus.
Yeah. You and Klaus, man.
I just want a whole, like, side movie about Klaus. Like, I want a Staten Maine style movie about Klaus trying to put together this play. I don't know
Which,
why.
By the way, the play looks like you would expect it to look as a central German director.
Is this the Better Call Saul of Klaus des Hills Maria about
Please,
Klaus?
Dear God, yes.
Yes. But I would rather see a Waiting for Guffman style mockumentary about Klaus trying to put on a play.
And then the final thing I want to talk about is a dual thing. It's the scene between Maria and Joanne, wherein Joanne just turns on bitch mode and just doesn't stop.
Oof.
And I mean, like, not even polite. Like, Maria says, you know, when I played it, I did this, and, you know, it would give the audience a little more time to think about Helena. And Joanne just says point blank, at that point, I don't think anyone really gives a fuck about Helena. And just, like, not even, just, like, the most gratingly, cloyingly mean, like, 30 Rock style, if anyone saw Chloe Grace Moretz in 30 Rock.
Yes.
Yeah.
Chloe Grace Moretz looks extremely fierce in that scene, too, because she is all teeth. I don't know what happened, but she went from she's sort of shrinking and obviously acting very self-conscious when they first meet and uncomfortable. And then in that scene, her face just takes on this incredible, like, viciousness, and I just saw nothing but teeth. It was really, I don't know, it was really interesting. But
no, I know what you mean. She's like feral. Yeah. She's like got her teeth like an animal. And this is after she was like ebullient. Is that even the right word? Just so fucking nice to her the first time.
Well,
she
can't even remember the title of the film that she watched.
Yeah.
That supposedly inspired her to become an actress.
Yeah, it sounds like one of the more inconsequential films that she would have been in.
It was her first Hollywood film.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, you got to think about it. Like, that's probably what she would see that would make her want to act. I mean, she saw this great actress in a shithole Hollywood film with Harrison Ford in the mid-90s, you know, which we all remember as Harrison Ford's Air Force One period.
Great stuff.
Great. I mean, I love Air Force One. Don't get me wrong. But
it's much better than anything he's making nowadays, you know?
Especially Star Wars. Oh, Flame War started.
Ooh.
Check the comments.
Shots fired.
I haven't even seen it yet. Let's calm down.
I joke, but actually I did enjoy his moment in the trailer.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Like, it was I know I joked about his time at the trailer, but it is crazy how just more alive he seemed in that moment than he did in the entirety of Crystal Skull.
Hey, man, I'm a big defender Crystal Skull.
Oh, my God, Nick.
quite like his performance in that. Crystal Skull's very good. I will fight everyone here.
Nick, you came out of left field with that.
Damn. Yeah. All right.
I'm intrigued.
So add on to the drunk podcasts, Labor Day, Ninth Gate, and Crystal Skull.
And wait, who likes Labor Day?
I said that Labor Day was cloying and saccharine and stupid and wholly effective. I had some like series of really like derogatory adjectives that ended with "and it works." But I just want us to get drunk and watch that and then talk about it. Yeah. Anyway, the final part of this movie is our boy Brady showing up and trying to convince her to be in a science fiction film, which she hates. But again, going back to my point about stars looking for a storyteller to help them be themselves, he has a vision that seems to get through to her.
And he also, and I think that's the other thing about this film, is you think it's going to end with her being defeated and this new young, although horrible person is going to sort of take her place. But then she ends up being, you know, she kind of has the upper hand in the end.
Yeah.
So because
again, she found the storyteller that respects her substance over the flash and possible substance, but corrosiveness of Joanne.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, God bless him. Brady was there to help us out.
Hey, you may have talent, but if you're a nightmare to work with.
True.
Mm.
It's funny because my friend who I was watching this with, Brady Corbet, steps into the room and I just start laughing.
Yeah, I kind of laugh.
I think I literally said, "What's up, Brady?" She's like, "What?" And I'm like, "I'll tell you when the movie's over."
I gotta keep an eye out for this guy now.
Yeah, he's everywhere. Love him. Love him to death.
He looked familiar.
Well, of course.
Yeah, he definitely did.
He was also in Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene.
That's how I know him. Okay. Yep. All right, you got it.
Gotcha. He was in Saint Laurent, so there's that too.
Nobody saw that.
I know, but I'm just saying, as far as like arty European films that Brady Corbet has been in.
And then there's Simon Killer, which is deluded enough to think it's worthy of some of the great European directors at Apes. So.
And yet, I enjoyed Simon Killer.
Yeah, fuck you.
Wow, Jesus Christ. Wow. Welcome back, Nick.
Simon Killer just, like, that movie just, like, pisses me off. Sorry.
It's okay.
Nothing personal.
I don't mind. It's fine.
Is that the one where it's the guy who
dances yes. the LCD sound system? That kind of is a good description of the movie. The guy who...
well,
that's that character.
Is it that he could potentially kill his girlfriend, or he could potentially be
he's
a serial killer?
His name is Simon. He is potentially
a killer.
What?
I will say that in the movie, his last name is not Killer.
It is Clouds.
But that's again Clouds of Sils Maria outpacing Birdman, in that it shows that there are it's all about theme and intent, and just giving someone superpowers is not an automatic deterrent to quality.
And she was, and I think they even say in an X-Men movie,
yeah, she was Nemesis.
Which is that a...
I don't know.
Sorry.
I'm going to look it up right now.
Anybody? I'm not that big of a nerd, Brian.
If Dan Gavazdin was back on this podcast, he could tell us everything. It does not... Oh, wait. X-Men Nemesis? It's... I don't think that's a real thing.
X-Men Apocalypse?
What?
X-Men Apocalypse?
But her character is named Nemesis. Oh, wow. Wait a second. Apparently it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
There's a Dr. Nemesis.
Is it a woman?
It looks like it's a kind of... No?
I find it.
If you're looking at this picture, it's kind of crazy. It says Nemesis was sent to kill as many of Magneto's young students as he could while the X-Men were off fighting Apocalypse's horsemen.
Mm-hmm.
He was defeated in a battle with the Scarlet Witch. Which is weird, because I think that Scarlet Witch was a character in the sci-fi movie.
Yeah.
And that really... I was confused deeply.
I was also confused about that.
But anyway...
I find it kind of beautiful that I actually know somebody who did an interview with Juliette Binoche when this was playing at the New York Film Festival, and they asked her about her role in Godzilla, and her response, they asked her, What was that like, you know, having that basically walk-on role in Godzilla? And they said, how would you feel if you were the only real woman in this big blockbuster and you die in the first 5 minutes?
Oh God.
Yeah, so it's interesting.
Shots fired at Elizabeth Olsen.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
Poor her. What did she... Oh. She didn't ask for that. Anyway, it's kind of funny how, again, the boundaries between art and life blur in many ways. Indeed. With this film.
Mm-hmm, very much so.
It's very, very much... Very much an extra textual piece of work, you know? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I did enjoy...
The more you know, the more you love
it. I did enjoy it.
Yes, great. I think we all did. I think that I can say that as it stands, this is probably one of my top five movies of the year. And because I did see it this year, and it's getting released this year, so I'm counting it for this year.
As am I.
Excellent. Excellent. Mm. All right. Well, that's it for that. We're going to briefly run through what's available on Blu-ray, and then we'll be out of here.
Taken 3.
I was about to say, great news, guys. There's not a lot of good stuff going on Blu-ray. I'll start off with A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. Haven't seen it. Heard good things.
Brian.
I'm fucking working on it, okay?
Dude, it's streaming.
Okay, I'll watch it. I'll watch it tomorrow. Because I got Mad Men tonight. We also have Taken 3, as Danny said. We have Everly with Selma Hayek. And that's kind of it for new releases. Yeah, we got The River being released on Criterion Blu-ray.
Mm.
I have seen that. That's great.
Blu-ray of Escape to New York.
From. Ooh. Big difference.
There's a big difference.
Yeah.
Still a classic, though. We have Cake, actually, the Jennifer Aniston film that everyone was laughing about the fact that it might get an Academy Award.
Oh my God.
We also have a Blu-ray re-release of Biodome. Everyone is choosing to ignore that. So any of these tickling your fancy, gentlemen?
Well, The River is fantastic, and I imagine the Criterion Blu-ray just looks spectacular. I believe Martin Scorsese once said that either it has the single most beautiful transcendent moment he's ever seen in a film, or at least the greatest use of voiceover. Some very emphatic, almost hyperbolic statement from Scorsese about The River. It's a great movie. It's just kind of this insane, colorful explosion that's also very, very gentle. So if you have a Hulu Plus, you can watch it on there. And
wow.
Then Escape from New York, I admire, but I'm actually more of an Escape from LA man myself.
Oh, see, that's a big schism in this world.
Yeah.
New York is very serious. Skull,
you love Escape from LA.
Escape from LA for me is the is kind of like what I wanted to see when I saw Escape from New York when I was 14. But
you wanted to see him make an impossible basketball shot?
Oh God, I love that scene.
I would say I tried to watch Escape from New York not too long ago thinking I would love it. Meh.
It's kind of dry.
It is. I was expecting something a lot crazier, and yeah.
Well, then you should check out Escape from L.A.
You know, I think I will.
Do it.
I will.
Great. That's it for today. Let's tell the fine people at home where we can be. Nick Newman, first of all, it's been great to have you back again.
Thanks. It's good to be done with my senior thesis as well.
Yeah. What was it on?
I don't know, man.
You just spent all this time writing
crystal
it.
Skull? It was about the crystal skull, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was actually a 40-page defense of Indiana Jones and the King of the Crystal Skull.
I would probably read that.
At your thesis defense, they just lit it on fire and threw it at you.
but no, if you don't know, that's why I was gone, really. And then I got back, yeah. And it's like I'm kind of in the final weeks of college, and
yeah.
Sometimes.
Are you in undergrad or are you in graduate?
Undergrad.
He's like 16 years old.
Wow, you had a thesis? Man, my film studies program was not nearly as...
Yeah, I don't have to do anything like that.
Yeah, it is what it is.
Fuck you, Nick.
Yeah.
Yeah, I knew it was something school related, but, you know, Amanda, everyone loves Amanda, so...
Oh, no, yeah, no, no, she's great.
I mean,
she's right here, so we can't be too mean about her. But.
So I'm gonna hang up first, I'm guessing, and you guys are just gonna
rail on you.
That's
anyway.
Okay. That's okay. I see you hating.
I do all my hating openly.
That's true.
Though I will say I haven't said a shitty thing about Pittsburgh in like two episodes.
That's true, you haven't. Hey, we have alligators in the river apparently.
Oh really?
Mm-hmm. super exciting.
I don't. There's something to be said for that, but I just can't even think of what it is.
According to some locals, there are alligators in the river. So I'm guessing
that makes me like Pittsburgh more.
There's never a dull moment in Pittsburgh.
As with any post-apocalyptic society,
yes,
every day is an edge of your seat thrill ride.
Escape from Pittsburgh.
Oh my God! Anyway, Dick Newman, where can we find you online?
As always, thefilmstage.com and twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
Danny King.
Thefilmstage.com, twitter.com/TheKingBolton, and clouds.
Okay. Amanda Waltz. What about you?
Twitter at MediaWaltz. You can also check out my blog, Steel Cinema, on WordPress.
Now, Steel Cinema, is that because the crime rate in Pittsburgh is so high that movies are constantly being stolen?
Oh, God.
Wait, what?
Sorry. Anyway, I can be found on twitter.com/BrianJRowan.
You're getting lazy, Brian.
Thefilmstage.com. I'm going to just ignore that. Just like your public works department. Anyway, and you can hear my other podcast, Movie Dare, on iTunes or at movie-dare.com. We will be talking next about The Magic Puppy. So that's going to be a fucking thing. Anyway, join us next week. We're hopefully going to be able to talk about Ex Machina.
Oh, man.
Because that's apparently going live next week.
Oscar Isaac looks so hot in that movie.
I was going to say the same thing about Vic Lender. I don't remember her first name. But Ex Machina. Alicia Vic Lender. So, yeah, check it out. It's apparently very good. I'm excited to talk about it.
Really, really just stressing your heterosexuality there.
Really? Because I was really leaning into Klaus for a while.
Oh, I was going to say, it's like, Oscar Isaac looks hot. Hey, you know who else looks attractive? Anyway.
I mean, she's primarily a robot. I'll say that between Oscar Isaac and Domhnall Gleeson, I gotta go for Gleeson.
Huh.
But that's just because he played Levin. He played Levin in Anna Karenina, and I've had a weird, like, aspirational man crush on Levin ever since I read that book. So
wow.
Not that Domhnall Gleeson, he's a looker too, but I feel like, well, I don't know. Let's not play favorites.
Isaac has that kind of tough boy quality.
He's got a beard that you could fucking die for.
Ugh.
As a man who wears a beard, I look at Oscar Isaac and I'm like, why do I bother?
Oh, God. Man.
So you guys are obviously excited for The Force Awakens because you're getting...
Both of them.
Oh, The Force is going to awaken.
All right.
Any
talk of female sexuality makes me extremely uncomfortable.
Creepy,
so
creepy lady on the podcast.
Does that mean that you call...
Stop.
No, Brian, no, okay. No.
Anyway, that
just cut it off right here. Just like when you're editing it, just end it right there. No music. Just
is that going to be the like you did with the Three Dicks box set with me? You're just going to
should you make this the last podcast
ever?
Last podcast ever, and just end it right there, and there's just nothing ever after that.
We just don't even acknowledge that it ever was.
We're like, Val. We just go off into the end of the Alps, never to be found, never to be seen again.
And then we return just to review The Force Awakens.
So, Amanda, was your Force awakened, and how violently was it woken up?
Okay.
Yikes, Brian, man.
What has been happening? What have I missed? What has been happening on the show?
Obviously, the sexual tension on the show has come to a breaking point. The return of Nick Newman.
Mm. I tend to have that effect.
Yeah.
I'm kind of a,
you
kind
do,
of like a
you
king
do.
Mixer. Yeah.
Yes.
Damn right. You
as soon
like
as you walk in a room,
staff.
Everybody's like, ooh.
You're like the perfume in the movie Perfume.
Oh, yeah.
Nick Newman, Audible.
Wow, that is a really deep reference there.
I know, but I like
no one
that
talks
movie.
About that movie.
I like that movie.
It's okay.
It's a damn good movie.
Alright.
Anyway.
Anyway.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Tune in next week.
I'm going to venture a guess you're going to cut a lot of that out.
I have to cut a lot of that out, yeah. Let us move now into our feature review, which is of the... nah, fucking shit, goddammit. I almost did the definite article.
I'm going to venture a guess. You're going to cut a lot of that out.
I have to cut a lot of that out, yeah.